From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, November 13, 2008. Curious how high the bailout will get? Well, one top senator says it's close to $5 trillion. We'll go to Rwanda, where diplomatic tensions with Europe are deteriorating. And we'll hear about what to expect from this weekend's G20 summit. I'm Aura Bogado. Stay tuned for that and more after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Senate vote in Alaska seems to be swinging away from the Republicans today. Democratic candidate Mark Begich has taken a lead over incumbent and convicted felon Ted Stevens. Stevens had been leading in the polls since Election Day, but as the state began to tally absentee and early ballots, the Anchorage mayor pulled ahead by 800 votes. State officials say there are still nearly 30,000 ballots waiting to be counted. Most of those will be tallied tomorrow and next week. In other political news, President-elect Barack Obama announced today he's resigning from the Senate effective Sunday. Hurricane Ike was one of the top five most destructive storms in U.S. history, and the effects of the September storm are still being felt along the Gulf Coast of Texas. Authorities are still unable to find 11 people reported missing, and they fear some of the bodies were swept into 55 giant debris piles scattered throughout the region. And today, the University of Texas announced it was laying off nearly 4,000 people. That's about one-third of the workforce at its medical branch in Galveston. Officials say the hospital is running out of money and is still dealing with massive Ike-related damage. The hurricane caused about $700 million in damage to the buildings, and the university hospital was only insured for about a seventh of that. Germany officially slid into a recession for the first time in 5 years, officials announced today. Europe's biggest economy shrank 0.5% in the third quarter after a similar contraction earlier in the year. The German downturn is furthering fears of worldwide recession, and a prominent economic think tank, the Capital Economics Research Group, fears that, quote, the world economy is headed for the worst recession since the 1930s. Cinnamon Nippard has more from Berlin.
The German government's independent Council of Economic Experts, dubbed the Five Wise Men, yesterday forecasted 0% growth for Germany in 2009. They also predicted an increase in unemployment of over 1%, which is about 3.3 million people. The council dismissed the government's bailout plans of multi-million euro tax breaks and state investment as a hodgepodge of isolated projects designed to give the impression that the government is doing something. Instead, the council called for more government spending to improve infrastructure and the educational system, even if that means increasing debt. German industrial giants are already preparing for the downturn. Car manufacturers Daimler and General Motors-owned Opel are both temporarily shutting down some of their German plants, and Siemens reported a net fourth-quarter loss of nearly $3 billion. As a result, Siemens is cutting over 16,000 jobs by 2010. Cinnamon Nippard reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Berlin.
In Afghanistan today, a suicide car bomber attacked a U.S. military convoy in a crowded market in the eastern part of the country. The blast killed one soldier and 18 civilians. In other news from the region, U.S. commanders are asking for an additional 3,300 U.S. troops to train Afghan police and military forces. Their goal is to double the size of the Afghan army by 2011. The Status of Forces Agreement, or SOFA, between Iraq and the United States is being reviewed by the Bush administration. If the SOFA passes, the U.S. will be allowed to build military bases, camps, and prisons in the wounded country. But as the potential for stability hovers on the horizon, violence is once again becoming the norm. In the most recent attacks, Iraqi officials say 20 Iraqis were killed and 84 others were wounded. Hiba Dawood has more.
In the past 24 hours in Baghdad, a car bomb exploded, killing 12 and wounding 60 others. In addition, an IED went off inside a bus, killing one passenger, and another IED exploded inside a police car, wounding 3 policemen and 3 civilians. Violence also persisted in Diyala province, where 5 Iraqi soldiers have been killed in bomb blasts. There, the Iraqi army arrested 6 people in connection with the deaths, among them 2 Saudis and 1 Syrian. Meanwhile, a man wearing a police uniform opened fire at U.S. soldiers in Mosul. 2 died in the attack, and several others were injured. It remains unclear whether the man was a policeman. So far, 5 U.S. soldiers have been killed in Iraq during the month of November. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Hiba Dawood.
And finally, the National Transportation Safety Board announced today a design flaw, not corrosion, was the primary factor in last year's deadly Minneapolis bridge collapse. This finding takes some of the onus of blame off state officials, who would be responsible for maintaining and mitigating corrosion, but would have had little control over design issues in the 50-year-old bridge. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
The financial crisis continues to mount. Numbers released today reveal that home foreclosures have increased by 25% from a year ago. 250,000 homes received a notice of foreclosure last month. And the number of people who filed for unemployment benefits, that's the official measure of joblessness, has hit a 7-year high. Meanwhile, the federal government continues its effort to revive the financial markets. As FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports, a top senator says the price tag of the financial bailout is close to $5 trillion.
While much of the attention is placed on the $700 billion bailout plan, the federal government is actually providing financial institutions with 5 times that amount. Senator Chris Dodd, chair of the Senate Banking Committee.
There's been $5 trillion, not just $2 trillion, that's gone out with all the various issues I raised here this morning.
$5 trillion, that's 5 times the entire annual U.S. budget and 6 times the direct costs of the Iraq War. The money is going to insure bank accounts up to $250,000, say Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and guarantee money market funds, all of which the details have been made public. But what the Treasury and the federal government has not advertised is $140 billion in additional tax breaks to financial institutions. And other little-known programs, Bloomberg reports that the Federal Reserve has given out or promised $2 trillion in loans to financial firms. The $2 trillion in Federal Reserve loans did not need approval by Congress. The feds used their existing power to expand loan programs. They refused to reveal who the money went to and how it's being spent. Bloomberg is suing the Federal Reserve to find out. Senator Chris Dodd, fully aware of the Fed's program, says he's concerned but assures proper oversight is being done.
The General Accounting Office is on the ground at the Treasury conducting its accountability and oversight. So I read the stories, but they're moving pretty quickly on this and moving as quickly as you can. And there's no foot dragging that I sense and putting in place the individuals, to do this job.
But the job of oversight is also not clear. Congress required a board be put in place to oversee the government's bailout plan. That board has yet to be named. Additionally, the Treasury Department's Inspector General told the Washington Post that the bailout is, quote, a mess. While $5 trillion of taxpayers' dollars are being promised to financial firms, President Bush at the Manhattan Institute in New York City seemed to contradict the federal government's actions.
All this leads to the most important principle that should guide our work. While reforms in the financial sector are essential, the long-term solution to today's problems is sustained economic growth. And the surest path to that growth is free markets and free people.
President Bush appears to be practicing those free market principles when it comes to the auto industry and people facing foreclosure. He and Treasury Secretary Paulson have indicated opposition to auto industry assistance. Paulson also said yesterday he's opposed to a plan offered by FDIC Chair Sheila Bair to modify home loans. Martin Eakes, president of the Center for Responsible Lending, says the only way to stem the financial crisis is to help homeowners, which he says can be done in 2 ways. By transparent loan modification, similar to what Sheila Bair has proposed, and allowing people facing foreclosure to file for bankruptcy.
So I just, I know I'm being overly passionate about this, but, I've been watching the 9,000 per week, per day, 45,000 people lose their home and go into foreclosure every week. We don't have any time to spare. And it just drives me berserk.
Senator Dodd indicated that when Congress returns to Washington next week, it might not move forward on an auto industry bailout because of lack of Republican support. He said Congress, though, might try to pass bankruptcy reform for homeowners. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
President Bush has called for a meeting of the world's 20 top economies, including India and China. The G20 summit will take place at the White House this weekend, and leaders are hopeful that they'll put forward a proposal to stabilize and renew confidence in a fragile world economy. Maya McGuinness is the president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget at the New America Foundation. She's optimistic that the discussion includes a broad group of players.
Well, clearly all of the economic hardship that the world is facing right now is not able to be addressed by countries sort of pulling back into their own individual boxes. And it's a time to open up and enhance global communication about issues that are interrelated, and the economic crisis is first and forefront of everybody's mind. It's also critical that it's not just be the traditional players who have tried to dominate global finance, but it's a broader group of people. So I look at this as the first of many, many discussions that are likely to come, and hopefully it will be as much a trust-building exercise as it will something where anybody expects for real solutions to emerge.
And what will the Bush administration be focusing on in the summit?
Well, I think that there will be a tension between trying to create the sense of inclusiveness with all the countries that will be at the table, but also America's leadership. I think that many of the countries there will want to establish themselves as leaders in sort of the march out of the current situation. And the U.S. will be no different than some of the other European countries and Asian countries that would like to see that same situation. And I also think that it's a time for the U.S. to kind of rebuild some of its reputation and the fact that much of the economic problems are motivated from issues that we had domestically. And so we're going to need to find ways to lead the solutions as well.
And what, in your opinion, should world leaders be prioritizing?
Stability of the economic system. So it is time to make sure that there are no more surprises that can lead to sort of additional tipping points that catapult the economy into a lower level. The interrelatedness of all of these things mean that we have to have more coordination than we generally have in the past. But the biggest problem, of course, is the risk that the spillover effects from all the negative incidents in the economy make this situation worse than it has to be. Now, there are a lot of imbalances in the global economy that have to be worked out, from the excessive borrowing of the U.S. to the high leveragedness of many industries around the world to the unhealthiness of some of the borrowing that took place. Those things do have to work their way through the economy. So what we don't want to do is artificially prop up some of the problems, but instead find a way to rationally, systemically, and kind of orderly, have an orderly transition and resolution to a lot of those problems. So it's going to be an interesting combination of general freer market ideologies and a very aggressive new role for government that acknowledges just how bad things have gotten and also the necessary role of government in coordinating the solution.
President-elect Obama will not be at the summit. He says that there's one president at a time, and obviously Bush is still in power. He is, however, saying that former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright and Republican and former Congressman Jim Leach will be there to meet and to listen to delegations. What should these two be contributing and watching out for?
Well, actually, as representatives of the Obama team, what they should be doing is listening. It is a great opportunity for them to be the faces of the new listening tour. President-elect Obama has shown himself to be kind of a very thoughtful and get as many opinions as possible into his decision-making and a thoughtful way of working through them. And I think that what he's going to expect of the two faces of the Obama administration is for them to be available and listen as much as possible to what the leaders of the other nations want to share with them, go back, report it, and help the discussion for the new Obama administration figure out how they're going to lead out of this. Because absolutely, there is only one president at a time. It is still President Bush's watch. He's the one who's called this meeting. He's going to figure out what the role of the U.S. should be in it, but it may take a very different tack under the Obama administration, and I think they will wisely listen to what they hear from all the people who are here as they are able to establish their whole kind of map for U.S. leadership in the situation going forward.
Maya McGuinness is the president of the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget at the New America Foundation.
The Bush administration quietly reduced the number of services that can be provided to people under Medicaid in September, although it won't take effect until next month. But healthcare advocates warn that millions of people will lose coverage for vital services as a result, Africa Jones reports.
Hospitals around the country say they could lose millions of dollars in Medicaid payments. Melissa Stanford Jones is president and CEO of the California Association of Public Hospitals and Health Systems.
This rule would reduce Medicaid support for critical hospital outpatient services. The rule that they're putting in place would narrow the definition of what a hospital outpatient service is, which would really limit the support for these essential outpatient services.
The new rule redefines Medicaid coverage in hospitals to exclude services that could be provided outside of the hospital, for example, dental and diagnostic services. Stanford Jones said as the economy worsens and more people lose jobs, the safety net of Medicaid is critical.
The need for the public hospital safety net is only increasing, not decreasing. You know, this is a time when the safety net is needed to catch more people. And our serious concern here is that this rule is very short-sighted in that it's really undermining a key aspect of the healthcare system, of the healthcare safety net.
The new rules take effect in December, but Congress has imposed moratoriums on six other proposed rules that would have cut Medicaid. California Congresswoman Barbara Lee, co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, says they are working to stop or reverse these changes.
They kept vetoing the Children's Health Initiative. They wouldn't even allow that. We've got to try to beat them back, fight hard until President Obama is sworn in, and try to unravel some of these very inhumane, immoral, and unethical policies.
Medicaid provides health insurance for more than 50 million low-income people in the United States. As the Bush administration attempts to scale back Medicaid, congressional leaders and governors have been pushing for an expansion of the program to help the increasing number of people affected by the recession. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Africa Jones.
Chile's new health minister told his country's Congress this morning that the public health service neglected to tell hundreds of people that they tested positive for HIV. His predecessor was forced to quit last month after it was discovered that at least two people who tested positive were not informed and later died. FSRN's Jorge Garretón reports from Santiago.
More than 500 unreported cases of people carrying the HIV virus, according to Chile's health minister, Álvaro Erazo. Speaking to Chile's Congress this morning, Erazo said that more than half of those infected, public health officials responsible for AIDS screening made no effort to notify them of their condition and what kind of free treatment is available to them. The minister added that the remainder public health made just one failed attempt to contact. The minister says he's investigating.
All the irregularities in how people aren't being notified are to be condemned. We will take strong action to find out why the system failed, and we will investigate public health officials to see if they did their jobs.
The move follows the revelation this weekend that a number of HIV centers and blood banks in the many cities in the country failed to notify people who came for HIV screening that they tested positive. Last month in the northern city of Iquique, Health Ministry admitted that at least five people with the HIV/AIDS were not notified of their status for at least 5 years. Three people reportedly died because their illness went untreated. This despite the fact, in Chile, HIV/AIDS treatment is free. Rolando Jimenez, with Chile's main gay, lesbian, and transgender rights organization, is outraged. He says there's plenty of blame to go around.
Here are the three levels of blame. First, the people who went in for screening were told that they were positive and needed to come back once the test was confirmed. The second level is blood bank officials who failed to follow up and act on the cases where patients with positive tests failed to come back. They showed a complete lack of care and interest in their jobs. The third level of blame is the organized civil society in the area.
Jimenez says the NGOs that are responsible in assisting people living with AIDS also failed. Now the investigation continues to find out where are the people who are HIV carriers and if they have contaminated others. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
There's an unprecedented diplomatic confrontation taking place between Rwanda and Europe. On Sunday, Rwandan President Paul Kagame's chief of protocol, Rose Kabuye, was arrested in Frankfurt while preparing for Kagame's visit to Germany. She was arrested on a two-year-old French warrant that accuses her and others of conspiring to shoot down the plane of then-Rwandan President Juvenal Habyarimana in 1994. That was the event which triggered the genocide in which a million people, the majority Tutsis, were killed. Kabuye's arrest has prompted Rwanda and Germany to recall their ambassadors, and Rwanda has threatened to issue arrest warrants against French officials accused of involvement in the genocide. Arusha Topazini reports from Kigali, where hundreds of protesters have taken to the streets since Sunday.
Hundreds of people braved the rain to protest against the arrest of Rose Kabuye, a woman nationally held as the heroine of Rwanda's liberation struggle that put an end to the 1994 genocide.
We are tired of disrespect from the Germans and the French people. She instead stopped the genocide.
But Europe does not agree with these Rwandans on the streets. Based on a questionable report by a French judge, German police arrested Rose Kabuye, who will be extradited to France soon. Kabuye is accused of involvement in the shooting down of the then-president Juvenal Habyarimana's plane, which sparked the 1994 genocide. The international community did very little to stop the genocide that killed a million people. Rwanda's Tutsi community and moderate Hutus were systematically targeted by extremist Hutu militias. The violence ended after the victory of the current President Paul Kagame's Rwandan Patriotic Front over the Hutu militias. 15 years later, Europe's sudden intervention in arresting the Rwandan official has irked Kigali. Rwanda has accused France of bullying and Germany for violating Kabuye's diplomatic immunity.
We've seen cases where individuals accused of genocide given safe haven in European countries. We've seen a number of accusations toward the current Rwandan government that are unfounded.
That was Louise Muchikiwabo, Information Minister. The Rwandan investigation, known as the Mucho Report, accuses senior French army officers and government officials, including former President François Mitterrand, in the 1994 genocide. The setting up of the Mucho Commission prompted France to issue indictments against 9 senior Rwandan officials in 2006. Rwanda broke off ties with France after it issued arrest warrants. José Cabago was the rapporteur on the Mucho Commission. France's defensive reaction, he says, signals deeper post-colonial fears of losing control over Africa.
In a final analysis, perhaps it's a good thing that Rose Kabuye will be tried in France, since it puts the ball back in the court of French justice. It's clear to many people that this is France trying to get revenge for the fact that Rwanda is no longer under its zone of influence.
Rose Kabuye's trial date has been set for early January. Meanwhile, neighboring countries like Uganda and Kenya have lodged official protests. Ugandan journalist Tabu Butangira comments.
This is a very complicated matter for developing countries to handle because the political and economic clout lies with the European and American countries. They control basically the international institutions from IMF, World Bank, but also more importantly, the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice. And so much of the instrumentation and the application of the provisions of those international protocols is the monopoly of developed nations.
Several genocide perpetrators have taken refuge in France. The arrest warrants issued by the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda has had little effect in bringing them home for trial. This, for the majority of Rwandans, is adding insult to injury. From Kigali in Rwanda, I'm Arusha Topazzini for Free Speech Radio News.
Facing recruitment shortfalls in urban areas, the U.S. Army has increasingly turned to video games and combat simulators to attract teenagers. A new $12 million video gaming entertainment complex in Philadelphia has taken military marketing into uncharted waters. The Army Experience Center is a two-year pilot program that, if deemed successful, could be replicated in other cities, FSRN's Daniel Denver reports.
With recruitment numbers down in major metropolitan areas across the country, the United States Army is increasingly looking to video games as a way to attract teenagers. The Army has invested $12 million into the new Army Experience Center, a 14,500-square-foot military-themed entertainment complex in Northeast Philadelphia's Franklin Mills Mall, offering visitors free high-tech video gaming and combat simulators. Major Larry Dillard, an Iraq War combat veteran and MBA who directs the center, says that he wants the public to know more about the Army's positive attributes.
We did some focus groups with teens and young adults in the area, and the one that struck me the strongest was young people think that joining the Army means you're going to die, and Iraq means you're going to die. Iraq and Afghanistan are very dangerous places, and every death and every casualty are huge tragedies. But I think the public grossly overestimates how prevalent those are.
Teenage visitors to the center are excited. They can use one of 60 consoles to play Xbox 360 games. There are also Humvee, Apache, and Black Hawk helicopter simulators. 20-year-old Private Jose Colon explained the Black Hawk simulator to me before I gave it a try.
They're actually inside of a Black Hawk. It's fitted with four M4s. They're protecting a convoy that's going through your tank.
And while national recruitment goals have been met, urban residents, especially African Americans, are increasingly unwilling to join the Army. The Army has decided that what industry insiders call experiential marketing is the key to combating underlying negative attitudes. While not everyone at the center on a Wednesday afternoon was planning on joining up, some were, and most said that they had a more positive view of the Army after visiting. The crowd was almost all boys, most in their teens. 19-year-old Gary Hatos was on his second visit to the center.
What do you come here to do?
Well, last time I came here, we played the games, and then we went to the simulation shooter, and then we were checking out the Google map. They were showing us where their bases are in Hawaii and stuff, and pretty much just to hang out.
Would you ever consider joining the Army?
Yeah, I would.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Has this place made that more likely, you think?
Yeah, after checking out some of the jobs they do, not just combat, there's like 100 and some jobs and only 7 are for combat, they were telling us. So I would consider someday joining the Army.
Eric, 23, has been a regular visitor to the center.
It's pretty neat. It's a good environment for kids to come in and play around, learn how to do stuff, especially simulators.
What's most interesting about this place for you?
I would say the simulators. It gets you to interact and what they do and shows you exactly how everything is.
Eric has considered joining the Army and thinks that the center might help him make up his mind.
It gives experience to people that really think about going into the Army, and then once they see how it is, then they'll give you a better prescription of it.
But critics say that the Army's stated educational aims are a ruse, and that the center is really just taking advantage of teenagers' enthusiasm for gaming. Nina Hunteman is a professor of media studies and an expert on video games at Suffolk University. She says that the games fail to show potential recruits the reality of war and perpetuate militarism in our culture.
I think it's disingenuous to use combat and entertainment to draw people to your brand, then to not talk about the reality of violence, and to suggest that, well, you're going to have these really safe jobs, you know, as a bureaucrat, but that, in fact, the violence is reality.
Throngs of teenage boys walk in and out of the new Army Experience Center, smiling and unscathed, but critics say that their safety in Iraq or Afghanistan cannot be so assured if they decide to enlist. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Daniel Denver in Philadelphia.
And that will do it for today's newscast. You have been listening to FSRN, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. Our newscast is produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod K. Joes. Our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell, and our headlines editors are Nell Abram and Jess Burns. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Puck Lowe, Rose Katapchi, and Oscar Hernandez. From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.